From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Republican fireworks and flameouts. It's down to four. It's still a race. The president says he won't rush a pipeline and a great big cruise liner on the rocks off Italy. In South Carolina, Newt Gingrich stepping up in the polls, battling an open marriage charge, and charges he's a chaotic manager. He was hot last night.
I think grandiose thoughts. This is a grandiose country of big people doing big things, and we need leadership prepared to take on big projects.
President Obama said no to the Keystone XL pipeline of tar sands oil across the Great Plains. Environmentalists celebrated. Oil men fumed. Here's American Petroleum Institute President Jack Girard.
How can you say you are for jobs and reject the largest shovel-ready project in America today? Mr. President, what are you thinking?
And the world heard the Italian Coast Guard dressing down cruise ship Captain Francesco Schettino as passengers struggled, died. He was off the ship. Get back on there, they said.
Avanti! Ci sono già dei cadaveri, Schettino! Avanti!
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Juan Williams of Fox News, David Sanger of the New York Times, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation. Republicans, are you getting to the right contender or not? Who's showing what colors, what character? And what about Keystone? What about the Costa Concordia? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us this week is David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for the New York Times, author of The Inheritance. David Sanger, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Also with us from Washington, just back from South Carolina, Juan Williams, political analyst for Fox News, columnist for The Hill. He was one of the questioners at Monday night's big GOP debate in Myrtle Beach. Mixed it up with Newt Gingrich. Juan Williams, welcome back to you as well.
Good to be with you, Tom.
And On Point News analyst Jack Beatty joins us from Hanover, New Hampshire, with a sharp eye on the South. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, David, and Juan.
All right, let's dive in right away. Last night, Juan Williams, you were there in the Lions' Den on Monday night, or I don't know who was the Lions. Last night, the open marriage news that had come out, the latest telling of it that had come out of ABC News was first up, and we heard right at the top of the hour there, Newt Gingrich really firing back hard on that. Was it effective? Did he tamp it down? Is he on his way to a maybe upset victory one?
Potentially so. I mean, he's the one who's been gaining momentum over the last few days in polls in South Carolina. Any poll that's been done since Tuesday shows him now in a tie and maybe even a little bit of a lead over Mitt Romney, which is a surprise because Romney had a substantial lead before these two debates in South Carolina. And last night, in the way that he handled the question about Marianne Gingrich's former wife claiming that he had requested an open marriage, he turned that question away from any issue of infidelity in a very socially conservative state to conservative discontent with the American media, liberals, and elitists, and got two standing ovations. So that was pretty strong.
We'll look at that. David Sanger, what do you make on the substance, on the character of what's happening in the polls here as we approach this kind of critical juncture in South Carolina tomorrow? Who's up, who's down? What does it mean about what Republicans are looking for in policy and persona?
Well, you know what? I've been struck by sort of the absence of much policy discussion. I mean, if you think about last night's debate, the first question was on Newt Gingrich's marriage. And while the revelation from his ex-wife made a lot of headlines, it was not exactly the first time that we knew that this had been, a tough moment in Newt Gingrich's life, or that he had an affair going while he was married and so forth. So I think it became a little bit easier for him to go beyond that. For my money, the most interesting answer in the debates all week came from Mitt Romney before his 15% tax rate reference. Mm-hmm. When he said in the earlier debate this week that he was opposed to any negotiated settlement with the Taliban. In other words, the one way that both Republicans and Democrats have talked about ending the war in Afghanistan. And it was sort of remarkable to me. We had a Republican candidate saying, let's stay and fight for a good number of years, And people weren't talking about that. I think it's pretty interesting.
We'll come back and look at the fireworks last night, but that was an important policy moment. Jack Biddy, let's listen for just a moment here. This was the Fox News Wall Street Journal GOP debate host Bret Baier of Fox News asked former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney about foreign policy and got to the war in Afghanistan.
Governor Romney, should the United States negotiate with the Taliban to end the fighting in Afghanistan?
Of course not. And Speaker Gingrich is right. Of course you take out our enemies, wherever they are. These people have declared war on us. They've killed Americans. We go anywhere they are and we kill them. And the right thing for Osama bin Laden was the bullet in the head that he received. That's the right course for people who kill American citizens.
Jack Biddy, where are we headed here? We've learned a lot in 10 years, but you wouldn't necessarily know it in that remark. You know, they declared war on us. We'll kill them wherever they are. Are we back to the global war on terror if Mitt Romney's in the White House, Jack?
Well, one of his main advisors now in foreign policy, of course, is the redoubtable John Bolton, who was given a recess appointment as U.N. ambassador and who was perhaps one of the leading I don't know if neocon or paleocon. In any case,
he of the great mustache and bulldog stance toward the planet.
Toward the planet, pretty much. And that seems to be the person who's got Mitt's ear on foreign policy. It's at one with his really dramatic statement. He says if Barack Obama is reelected, Iran will get a nuclear weapon. If Mitt Romney is elected, they will not get a nuclear weapon. So he's really coming down strong on foreign policy, and recent polls suggest there's a little room there, especially on the Iraq issue. A plurality of Americans disapprove of the way President Obama is handling the Iran issue. So foreign policy is not salient this year, but he has certainly staked out a dramatic, stark contrast.
Hasn't been salient, and yet there's been plenty of war drum kind of background music here around Iran. David Sanger, do you think this presidential debate, as it comes out of the primary season and gets part to be party on party, could it be once again about war, whether to stay in and kill them all in Afghanistan, how to deal with Tehran? Is this a war debate shaping up with President Obama?
Well, I doubt it is, because I think the economy sort of so overwhelms the other issues. But it does raise a fascinating question about what each of these candidates took away from the past 10 years of fighting in Afghanistan and then Iraq and the confrontation with Iran. And, you know, as you know, Tom, I spent a lot of time on the Iran issue.
Yes.
And if you just look across the board here, many of the actions the United States is taking right now, oil sanctions for the first time on Iran. You're seeing a lot more active sabotage of the Iranian program, although much of that also began in the Bush administration. There are many steps that are going on that may not be sufficient to keep Iran from getting a bomb, but certainly are designed to try to keep the United States out of an open confrontation. And so what I find interesting about this debate is it hasn't sort of addressed the question, what's a smart way to slow or stop Iran from getting a weapon without actually getting us into a third war in the Middle East and South Asia?
Campaign rhetoric may not be the most subtle on that front. I want to bring it back around to the economy through some of the money issues, which were very much in Mitt Romney's face on his plate this week. The news that he put out that he pays maybe 15% on his rather large income. The news of some millions of his stashed in the Cayman Islands. At the CNN debate in Charleston last night, he portrayed himself as a champion of capitalism, defending his wealth, defending his time at Bain Capital.
I'm very proud of the fact that throughout my career, I have worked to try and build enterprises, hopefully to return money to investors. There's nothing wrong with profit, by the way. That profit went to pension funds, to charities. It went to a wide array of institutions. A lot of people benefited from that. And by the way, as enterprises become more profitable, they can hire more people.
It's the heart of the Romney message. It took some hits this week, but Juan Williams, you're just back from South Carolina. What's going on with the Romney candidacy in South Carolina? These polls that now have Newt Gingrich neck and neck or even up on Mitt Romney, this was not the Romney script. What's going on, Juan?
He had, you know, a difficult time in the Monday debate handling the Bain questions, and that came as a surprise to me. because he had not only every opportunity, given the news about Bain and the attacks that were coming from his opponents back in New Hampshire, but he literally had guidance from his own top advisors and from commentators all over the country saying, you better have some good answers about your time at Bain Capital. And it just looked on Monday as if he was doing something analogous to, let's say, Dean Smith at North Carolina, you know, kind of a four corners stall, and just hoping that he could play out the clock because he had such a substantial lead. That opened the door to really harsh attacks and questions about when he would release his tax returns coming from Santorum and Gingrich. And as you know, in the Thursday night debate, Gingrich, during the course of the debate, released his tax return, and it indicated that he had paid a rate of about 30-plus percent. Meanwhile, we're getting dribs and drabs, some of it coming from inside the Romney camp, indicating that he paid only about 15% because he's paying it on carried interest or capital investments, and that he had some income apparently stored away in the Cayman Islands. And so we don't know the details on all this, but that's why he seems so defensive.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Wild ups, downs, and outs on the GOP trail. No Keystone XL pipeline cruise ship disaster. David Sanger is with us, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Juan Williams is here, political analyst for Fox News in South Carolina this week, right in the middle of the debate scene there. Jack Beatty is with us as well. Listeners, you can join us. Is the GOP going to put up a strong candidate at the end of all this? Strong enough? Or not. What do you make of the GOP sort of nearly roller derby this week? John Huntsman, out of the race this week. Rick Perry, governor of Texas, out of the race. Here he is yesterday at a press conference in Charleston, South Carolina, suspending his presidential campaign, throwing his support behind Newt Gingrich.
I believe Newt is a conservative visionary who can transform our country. We've had our differences, which campaigns will inevitably have. And Newt is not perfect, but who among us is?
Who among us is? That's a line you've heard from no small number of Republicans this year as they look out on this field, but it's time to choose. And then came this from ABC. This is on Nightline. Reporter Brian Ross sitting down with Newt Gingrich's second of three wives, Marianne, put her ex-husband's personal issues right back into the spotlight.
I said to him, Newt, we've been married a long time. And he said, yes, but you want me all to yourself. Calista doesn't care what I do.
What was he saying to you, you think?
He was asking to have an open marriage, and I refused.
There it was. Came up. First question last night. CNN host John King raised the question. Newt Gingrich came out blasting when he put that business on the table.
I think the destructive, vicious, negative nature of much of the news media makes it harder to govern this country, harder to attract decent people to run for public office. And I am appalled that you would begin a presidential debate on a topic like that.
All right. And there it was. It put him in a strong position in the internal dynamic of that debate. And we've got all kinds of response. David, Juan, Jack, here's one listener says online, the public is sick of media bias. It's as simple as that. On the other hand, here's Aaron in Iowa says Newt Gingrich presents a stunning example of hypocrisy. I agree the debate maybe wasn't the best place to ask him, but I can't figure why anybody would buy his answers. I've heard better defense on daytime soap operas. And Newt, of all people, should not be so appalled and clutch his pearls like Scarlett O'Hara over such a question. Jack Beatty, this is life as he's lived it. This was the Speaker of the House who brought a sitting president up on impeachment, you know, for a much, not a six-year affair. You know, what's fair? What's not?
Well, you know, I think in general, his point about the media is right. It is a poisonous climate. These things do come around. But he's not the man to make it, to make that point. I mean, he has specialized in poisoning the political atmosphere. I think he did it deliberately with Juan Williams in the Monday debate, where he really went after Juan not only for his question, but I think also for the fact that he's an African American. I mean, there was a real dog whistle. Doesn't quite get what he was doing with the food stamp issue and so on, but it was clear that he was working that that level of inflammability and nastiness. So he's not one to complain, it seems to me, about media, the media cesspool, since he has really been one of the objectively, there are few people in American politics who've been as deliberately polarizing as Newt Gingrich.
But that sort of high octane was working for him last night. Juan, David, let's listen just a little bit of that from Monday night when Juan asked the former Speaker of the House in the debate in South Carolina about pushback to Gingrich's statements that African Americans, quoting here, should demand paychecks and not be satisfied with food stamps.
You saw some of this during your visit to a black church in South Carolina where a woman asked you why you refer to President Obama as the food stamp president. It sounds as if you are seeking to belittle people.
Well, first of all, Juan, the fact is that more people have been put on food stamps by Barack Obama than any president in American history.
Juan Williams, you got booed on Monday night. There was a standing ovation for Newt Gingrich last night when he pushed back against John King. Is there some kind of fundamental mismatch between the mainstream media and voters, or South Carolina Republican voters? What do you make of those crowd responses for 1-1?
Well, I think that Newt Gingrich knows how to play the political debate game better than anybody. I mean, his rhetoric is hot. It appeals to resentment and anger on the part of very hard right South Carolina Republican voters, the people who were in the audience on Monday night for certain, who are, by and large, dismissive of the American media. They associate American media with liberalism. They think they're a bunch of elites, and they think that they have been defending President Obama. So when it comes to even broaching a subject like race in a state like South Carolina, which has a very difficult history of race relations and a very large black population, this is not extraneous. And Gingrich is the one who introduced the subject with his comments about saying that if he goes before the NAACP as president, he will tell them not to demand food stamps but to demand jobs.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, just as an observer, I haven't noticed any large organized efforts by black organizations, NAACP, or anyone else demanding food stamps. And I know, as we later heard from Jay Carney, the White House press secretary, that we've been through a very difficult recession, and food stamp usage went up just as much under President Bush as it has gone up under President Obama, and there was no recession during the Bush years. So to me, it looked like something that was intended to push a button, and guess what? It worked for Newt Gingrich.
David Sanger, is this the old welfare queen Southern strategy being pulled out again, or is Newt on to something substantive here that works?
Well, I think what is interesting about this campaign is that the income inequality issues have played both ways, even in the course of this week. So you have the exchange that you just heard, which, played, as you suggest, to this older card of government putting a lot of people on welfare. And then it took a turn in just 24 hours when Mitt Romney came out and said that his average tax rate was about 15%, and thus illustrated the Democrats' point out here, which is that one of the reasons that there's income inequality in the United States is that the rich pay a lower average tax rate if they're paying from their investments as opposed to earned income than ordinary working class people do. So what I think both parties have seen some electoral advantage here in driving this income inequality wedge, which of course is also a big theme of the Occupy Wall Street movement.
I mean, Jack, it's so interesting how that wedge goes here. It went against Romney on one day, and the next day Newt Gingrich is using it in another direction. Of course, many more whites on food stamps than African Americans in absolute numbers in this deep recession we've been in. You see race, economic realities, both at one time, Jack?
I think they're both at one time. Some people think class is going to be the main, valence of this election. But Ron Brownstein argues convincingly, I think, that really it's going to be a gray versus brown election.
Meaning?
Gray, older white voters who swung dramatically to the Republicans in 2010 are really crucial to any Republican hopes, and they're going to be played on by the Republicans, and the president is going to have to look to people like him. That is, people who represent the changing America, the newer America, the emerging America, and if that is going to be the race, gray, brown, then I think these racially tinged, ethnically tinged this language and this imagery, I think we haven't heard the last of it.
Hot stuff on the table in South Carolina: race, marriage, sex. Neil in Columbia, South Carolina is calling. Hi, Neil, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm actually a MBA student at the Moore School of Business.
Good for you.
I'm in the heat of it. So really, really quickly, number one, I don't the hypocrisy of the social conservatives to me is what's most appalling, and I'm sure many callers are going to talk about that, so I don't want to dwell on it, but just the indignation of Newt Gingrich to me is laughable. Number two, going back to foreign policy, I was actually very afraid of Governor Perry's remarks calling the Turkish government basically a terrorist organization. They've been one of our only allies in that part of the world. And it took a lot of compromise from them to help us with the war in Iraq. And for people not to call them on that, to me, is just mind-boggling, which then brings me to the next point, which you're right, is extremely scary, having a family in the military doing 2 and 3 tours, that they have this antagonistic attitude towards the Taliban. Yes, there are pockets that we need to deal with, but the bottom line is, we should have learned from Russia's 20-year war, or at least our 10-year war, that we got to get out of there.
Certainly finally, many in the U.S. military now, Neil, who want to find some negotiated way because it's looking tough on the ground. We've got more American troops dead there just in the last 24 hours, and no small number of them, apparently, from attacks by Afghan soldiers who are supposed to be their allies. Thanks for that, Neil. One more in Darlington, South Carolina. David, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hi, David.
I feel like I'm just contributing to the echo chamber. I'm appalled that Newt's appalled for all the reasons y'all have described. There was an article a few weeks, an interview with a Democratic representative up in, I want to say West Virginia, but I may be wrong, who's been in the House for a long time, and he attributed the divisiveness in Congress to Newt Gingrich. I just think it's appalling that Newt Gingrich is calling other people out for being divisive.
Well, you call it an echo chamber, David, but listen to this and watch the standing ovation there last night. That is a lot of people, and the polls prove this out, saying, yes, Newt's the one we want in this race.
Well, yes, I don't get a lot of the public in some of these debates. You know, the folks who cheered when they talked about letting the guy die in the gutter, I don't get a lot of the crowd in the debate.
Not your strand, but the polls showing a lot of support for Newt in this really important week. Tony in Charleston, West Virginia. Tony, you're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Pretty well. What do you think?
I'm just appalled about the fact that the Republican Party has this thinly veiled hatred of blacks in general, and this president in particular. You know, after the debate on Monday, that Tuesday, I saw a lady say that Newt had put Juan Williams in his place. And this is clearly a racial remark, and Newt didn't have the courage to confront her about it. Another instance was a couple months ago when one conservative lady said that their blacks are smarter than our blacks, as if blacks can still be owned. Mm. And my last point is to ask, when will blacks in the Republican Party realize that the Republicans really don't want you there, and they really don't care about you as a people?
Thank you, Tony. Juan, let me bring it to you. Is this just a one-week kind of show here in South Carolina, or is this a theme that goes on? And what do you make of Tony's perception?
Oh, this is in South Carolina politics. It's a deep and sad history. And just in terms of the political history, Tom, remember last time around, there were flyers, I guess it was 2000, there were flyers on cars suggesting that John McCain had a illegitimate black child. And he is, of course, adopted a child from Southeast Asia. So there was no truth to it. But again, it was playing to latent racism in the society. And, you know, I think that those kinds of political ploys seem to have some impact in South Carolina. And to my mind, the key question here is about the effort in South Carolina to require voter identification from voters. By their own statistics, there are about 82,000 registered minority voters who do not have that voter ID. It will disproportionately impact, and this comes back to something Jack was talking about, disproportionately impact young minority voters. They're the ones who don't have it. And the consequence will be a depressed level of voter participation from a group that Republicans know is not likely to cast votes for Republicans. Mm. So this is playing out, by the way, not just in South Carolina. This whole effort, somehow based on the abstract notion that there's so much voter fraud that we have to now increase the level of scrutiny for voters. There is no evidence of voter fraud, and it's all about the argument that if you ask the young people in our country, you know, up the millennials and under, who do you prefer, Romney or Obama? It's Obama by a large margin. If you ask the folks over 65, the so-called silent generation, it's overwhelmingly Romney. If you ask them about health care, the Affordable Health Care Act, derisively called Obamacare, again, the young people think it's a great idea. The seniors think it's a terrible idea. Mm. That's the kind of tension that's driving it, and then race plays directly into this divide.
West Hartford, Connecticut, David is calling. David, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom. You know, I don't think Newt Gingrich is actually a serious candidate. I don't think he could survive, you know, a general election campaign. I think he would put his foot in his mouth, and he will probably in the next 10 days. So my question is, A, how is Romney doing in Florida? And is there anything that your panel, which is a great panel, sees which would get in the way of the seeming inevitability of Mitt Romney's nomination?
David, thanks for your call. David Sanger, let me bring that one to you. Newt making a big splash this week, and Rick Santorum, too. But what about it? Is it still Mitt for the long run, or is there an open question now?
Well, I think there's always been some question, because I think there is a sense among Republicans that he's obviously among conservatives that he's insufficiently conservative, but then among some of the Republican establishment that there is some brittleness to his candidacy, that he has a difficult time being folksy, that he has a difficult time being able to empathize with working class Americans. And you saw some of that this week in the tax debate that we discussed earlier, and you see some of it in the reluctance on releasing the tax returns, which couldn't have come as a surprise to the Romney camp. I mean, every candidate has to go do this. So the big surprise here is that they've been fumbling around with what the right answer is. But I think that if, you know, as people sit at the White House, they would obviously prefer to run, I think, against Newt Gingrich. And their view is that they would, the White House view is, they would like this Republican primary to go on for as long as it can as the candidates begin to push each other to the right, because it's then a longer walk back to the center for the general election.
Well, if that's their view, they must have been happy this week. Fired up in South Carolina and lots of action in the GOP. David Sanger, please stand by. Juan Williams, Jack Beatty. News this week of Kodak. Big Kodak filing for bankruptcy, hoping to still stay afloat for a little while. 1970s, Paul Anka's Time of Your Life. Times of Your Life was a well-loved jingle for Kodak. Incredible. In bankruptcy now. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
While you may collect the dreams you dream today, remember, will you remember the times of your life? Of your life.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, Stephen Colbert, running with his faux presidential bid in South Carolina, had to give up his super PAC to Comedy Central colleague Jon Stewart.
I had to give away my super PAC. That's my baby. You know how hard it would be, how hard it is to give away your baby? Now imagine if that baby also had a whole lot of money. How much harder would it make it to give away your baby?
A whole lot of money. Queen of Southern Buttered Up Cooking TV celebrity chef Paula Deen revealed this week that she has type 2 diabetes, tried to put the best face on some dangerous diet.
On my show, you know, I share with you all these yummy, fattening recipes, but I tell people, in moderation, in moderation, you can have that little piece of pie.
That little old piece of pie. And comedian Ricky Gervais hit the stage again hosting the 2012 Golden Globes, his third time around, pulling no punches, even for his network that night, NBC.
Tonight, you get Britain's biggest comedian hosting the world's second biggest award show on America's third biggest network. Sorry, is it? It's fourth. It's fourth.
Okay, Ricky Gervais. We're talking about the week in the news, a little more politics here, and then we've got to look at the Keystone Pipeline and the cruise ship disaster. Juan Williams is with us, political analyst for Fox News. David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. Our own Jack Beatty is here. Jack, I've got a listener online here saying, come on, Tom. I asked, will the GOP put up a strong candidate? Listener says, what kind of question, comment is that? Jack, I guess I ask it because I'm hearing a lot of Republican friends not so sure where this field stands. Rick Perry says, you know, nobody's perfect, but there's a lot of enthusiasm there to go after President Obama. And still, I'm hearing from Republicans uncertainty about whether they're going to end up with that right amalgam of strengths. Do the best job, Jack.
Yes, some polls out this week that should give the Republicans some confidence. President Obama is doing very poorly among independents. 6 in 10 do not feel he doesn't share their priorities for the country. A majority of voters don't see him as having achieved much as president. He himself, of course, has perhaps grandiosely compared himself to FDR and LBJ in point of legislative accomplishments. But on the Republican side, Mitt Romney reportedly is haunted by what happened to his father. His father made a gaffe, said, you know, I'd been brainwashed in Vietnam by LBJ's generals, and that one remark, at least in legend, cost him any chance of defeating Richard Nixon in 1968. And Mitt is just determined, again, according to sources, that he is not going to make any such gaffe. And yet, like all of us, when he fixes, he can't avoid saying things that are going to get him into trouble because he's trying to avoid saying things that will get him into trouble. Thus, we have pink slips. Thus, we have I like being able to fire people. Thus, we have just last night, maybe the Democrats have already made that an ad. Maybe I'll release my tax returns. He's showing, you know, half, according to the New York Times, half of independents have yet to form an opinion of him. And right now, when they're starting to look, he's looking really at his weakness, at his weakest, because he's neuralgic about this issue of his own wealth. I thought he was handling the Bain issue pretty well in debate with Santorum on Monday. He said, "Look, I know this company in South Carolina closed down, but it was foreign competition, and I've got a tough line against China. I understand that." I thought he turned that pretty well, but his own wealth. He can't find the words for it. He's not getting good advice, and I think it's beginning to, well, just overnight, intra-trade, the political betting market has reduced his chances of winning South Carolina by 50%.
It was an awkward week on that front, no question. One more call down South Carolina way, Walterboro, South Carolina. Sue, you're on the air, Sue.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to speak about your earlier point about Newt Gingrich's comments in the debate last night and the response of the community to them.
Mm-hmm.
I think you're trying to simplify South Carolina too much. This is a very unique area. I've lived lots of places in lots of countries, and South Carolina has a very genteel and cultured side as well as a rural side.
No question.
And those people reflect something that I really am noticing and caring about, is, and that is that we're destroying people's ability to run because we're making it so painful. Not that we don't have to know about their character. We need to know about character. It counts.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't have any allowance for humanity. Gingrich grew up in a time when open marriage was one of the big discussions, along with pot and a whole bunch of other things, and many people experimented.
But we're talking about the 1990s here, Sue, not the 1960s. But I guess you're saying the standing ovation and cheering we heard, you're interpreting as cheering for what, a nicer atmosphere in the debates, a less acid atmosphere.
And a more, let's talk about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear what, and that's why what I feel Gingrich is appealing to is that he seems to have some perception, he's listening, and he's offering solutions. And that's why I see him gaining here.
Sue, I appreciate that call very much. David Sanger, how about it? We saw the standing ovation. We heard it there when Newt got tough with the very first question on open marriage out of the gates. Is that a cheer for substantive policy conversation, or is it a reaction to Newt's kind of, you know, visceral tough guy response?
I think it was more of the latter. And let's face it, you've got a debate like this. You have something of a self-selected audience. Running against the media is always a very easy thing to do. Let's face it, you know, the media, that would be all of us on this show. Thank goodness Congress actually polls lower, because until they started doing so, no one did. But the fact of the matter is, it's a very easy way to divert the question. Now, I think it's a reasonable question to ask that in a presidential debate, do you want to open up as the first question something like the question that John King asked here, and John has defended his decision on doing that.
Mm-hmm.
My concern about these debates, though, is that there hasn't been a huge amount of follow-up on the policy questions. That is to say, there have been policy questions asked, but the drilling down has been, I think, a little bit on the weak side. And that may have less to do with the candidates and the candidates individually than the very number of candidates who have been up on the podium. And now that the field is winnowed some, that we've seen two leave this week, I think it's going to give more time for people to really explore what candidates think about something.
Some drilling down in your newspaper this week, looking at the tax plans of the different Republican candidates and finding big deficit holes with those tax plans, even though the deficit's been a big issue on the campaign trail. Anita in Crenshaw County, Alabama. Anita, you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to comment on Newt Gingrich. It just amazes me how you all haven't called him out on a lot of stuff. You all are really giving him a pass on things. You all are focusing more, and you should, on Newt and on Romney's taxes. But I just told the lady, I said, you all focus more when Reverend said what he said. Y'all was talking about that every day, and y'all consider that racist because you felt like it was racism against white people. But Newt getting up here talking about welfare and black people, this, that, and all that right there, the most people on welfare are white people, but you all haven't said anything like that. The only place I heard that on was MSNBC. You all have just given this self-righteous, pompous bigot the right to just say the stuff he said and not call him on it. And I'm just saying President Obama has a good policy. Foreign policy especially. I mean, he's done most of everything those 3 years that George W. Bush is lazy behind, hasn't done in 8 years. So he has accomplished a lot. But the fact of the matter is, the reason why people don't want to look past him, he hasn't done much of anything, because you can't look past skin color. They can say what they will, and you all can try to sugarcoat as you want to, but that's exactly what it is.
Anita, we've got your passion and your point, and I take it fully. We have pointed out right here, yes, indeed, as you say, we just pointed it out, most food stamp recipients are not African-American. They're white. But, I mean, Juan Williams, you know, there's sort of two sides of it. You got Sue in South Carolina who says, come on, let's give some credit to the audience down here. On the other hand, Anita says, call this out tougher. This is race. This is self-righteous, pompous bigotry, she says.
Well, you know, I'm not going to go that far. I don't think that's my place, but she can make the judgment. I do think that there's no question that Newt Gingrich was playing to passions in that audience, and clearly the audience doesn't want to hear anything about it, the history of racism in that state, you know, with regard to the voter identification issue. They don't want to hear any challenge to the kind of rhetoric that Newt Gingrich has used in talking about not only minorities, but talking about President Obama as the so-called food stamp president. As we said earlier on this very show, Tom, you know, you see a very similar rate of increase in terms of the usage of food stamps in the country under President Bush as we have now seen under President Obama, and nobody was calling President Bush the food stamp president.
No, they were not. Paul in Westwood, Massachusetts. Yes.
Well, I just going to put in, Jenny Sanford was interviewed last night, the former governor.
This is the wife of the former ex-wife of former governor who had found his Argentine mistress.
That's right. And these questions about the food stamp imagery and so on were put to her. And she said, I wonder what Juan's reaction to this is. She said, look, this state is changing. She said, my congressman, she mentioned his name, Congressman Scott, is an African-American Republican. The governor, Nikki Haley, is an Indian American.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "This, you're trying to get us caught up in old-time stereotypes. That's not the new South Carolina. That's not the new South." What do you say about that, Juan?
So, what do you say, Juan? South beyond that? South Carolina beyond all that?
I don't know how anybody could think that somehow the whole racial dynamic of the South had been erased in a day. And remember, Tim Scott is a Republican. Nikki Haley, the governor, is a Republican.
Why not? That's their right.
That's fine. That's fine. But what I'm saying is they have chosen not to deal with 90% of the minority population in the state, which is minority and Democrat. And what you're seeing here is the political establishment in the state is overwhelmingly white, but the Republican political establishment itself is almost completely white. And it creates, I think, sensitivities and issues that people want to deny, want to turn their eyes away from. But I think it's a reality. And to ask me as a journalist or any of us to somehow just pretend that it isn't there is ridiculous. And Jenny Stanford to cite one Republican who's black or one governor who's has Indian American heritage, I think is essentially a veil, a beard on a very difficult issue for her.
Anita in Alabama, I appreciate your call. We're looking at the week in week in the news. Let's go to Paul in Westwood, Massachusetts. Paul, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just want to say something about Newt Gingrich. He's an excellent politician, and I know that he's going to be another Reagan if he becomes a president. Why are we focusing on, stupid things, I apologize, for stupid things like, what his ex-wife said. Common sense is not common. What do we expect for his ex-wife to say about him? That he was a wonderful man? No. Exes will never ever say that about their exes, So we just have to focus on who he is and what he can do for this country,
Paul, I take your point. We take your point loud and clear. On the other hand, history stands right before us, and he was the Speaker of the House when they tried to impeach a president over, fooling around with an intern. I don't know how you stack all that up. It was interesting in last night's Republican debate in Charleston. Rick Santorum went after Newt Gingrich. And, of course, everybody on that stage is paying these days because the Donnybrook, the fight is still on. But he went after Gingrich's open call for Santorum to drop out of the GOP race. Santorum said that he was the steady one. He said Gingrich just didn't have what he called Santorum cogent thoughts.
I don't want a nominee that I have to worry about going out and looking at the paper the next day and figuring out what is he worrying about, what he's going to say next. And that's what I think we're seeing here. For him to suggest that someone who was tied for first and eventually won the Iowa caucuses and finished with twice as many votes as he did and finished ahead of him in New Hampshire.
David Sanger, you're there covering the White House. Here's, Santorum saying, well, he's steady, suggesting that Newt may not be. There are ads on, and there are very tough ads on in South Carolina now. But, we're talking about management by chaos, throwing that accusation at Newt Gingrich's record as a congressional leader. He says, yeah, I've got grandiose ideas. This is a grandiose country. Somewhere in the middle of that spectrum, Americans are going to have to decide if he's a loose cannon or if he's just got the scale of ambition we need right now. How do you see that playing out, David?
Well, the first thing is that on his management skills, the harshest testimony we've heard came from within his own caucus after in the mid-90s. And, there was a reason he had to go leave that post. So a lot of that would get played back. He is a person of many grandiose ideas. He would be running, if he got the nomination, against a candidate against a sitting president who has proven himself, whether you agree with him or disagree with him, to be sort of the ultimate pragmatist. And this is probably one of the less ideological presidencies I've ever covered.
President Obama's.
I think in a way it would be a bigger contrast for voters between Gingrich and President Obama. I think the concern that many Republicans have right now is that in the case of Mitt Romney, he may be reaching, as he may have in that Afghan answer we were talking to about at the beginning of the show, to try to show differences that may not actually exist if he was in office.
The ad's running now saying, I think Santorum ad saying he's just like Obama. Juan Williams, the president's big move this week was saying no to the Keystone XL pipeline that would have brought energy from the Canadian tar sands right down across the Great Plains. Is that gone? Is he just putting it off until after the election? What do you make of this decision?
Well, they say it's not gone, but it certainly is gone in terms of presidential politics. I think that...
Well, not really, though, is it? I mean, already Republicans are beating up on him. Newt Gingrich called that move stupid.
No, I meant a decision that would come later before the presidential election. Mm-hmm. They're going to... It definitely feeds ammunition to people who say, you know, this is about jobs this time, given that the economy is the number one issue, and that this president who claims to be a job creator is ignoring the fact that there would be some number of jobs created, a number that's in great dispute.
Mm-hmm.
The supporters say 20,000 jobs. There's a study by Cornell indicates that there are about 5,000 to 6,000 jobs, and many of them would be temporary jobs, not permanent jobs. So, but the larger issue is, I think, in terms of politics, that environmentalists had been disappointed with this president, especially on the greenhouse gases front. We've seen people protesting in front of the White House on Keystone Pipeline. The environmentalists get a victory here, and they are big supporters, big donors to the president's reelection campaign.
So limited choices there. Maybe the right choice, wrong choice, depends on the party. Jack Beattie, sounds like we could be in drill baby drill chant territory again come convention time.
We're going to be hearing it all the time, I think.
Energy over all of our age. Jack Beattie, thanks very much for being with us today. David Sanger with the New York Times, always great to have you. And Juan Williams, political analyst for Fox News, just out of South Carolina. Thank you, Juan, as well. Thanks to all three. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.